Welcome to Ufahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Rachel Bede-Riedel, one of your hosts, and I'm joined today by a panel of experts talking about Senegalese politics. So I'm especially pleased and thankful to welcome our three guests, Maram Gay, Associate Professor of African and African Diaspora Literature at East Carolina University.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for being here with us. And Bamba Ndiaye, our Assistant Professor of African Studies at Oxford College of Emory University.
Hi, Rachel. Hi, Umar and Maram.
Thanks for being here, Bamba. And Umar Ba, Assistant Professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University.
Hello, glad to be here.
So thank you all so much for joining this conversation today, which is really a kind of timely update on the status of Senegalese politics and what's happening in the country as we see a large number of protests. We see a significant contestation over who the candidates will be in the lead up to the 2024 presidential election, and significant levels of discussion of the role of the judiciary, the role of human rights and gender dimensions. So we have a lot of questions on tap for you here. So I wanted to just lay it out first, kind of looking at the big picture stakes. What do you see as kind of explaining to our listeners the current state of democracy, contestations around democratic practices, the meaning of democracy in Senegal today? Can you give us a kind of big picture summary of what's happening as you see it? So Bamba, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, Rachel, for the invite. As many of us have seen recently, there has been a lot of political or socio-political tension in Senegal around the third term of President Macky Sall, or supposed third term or third candidacy of President Sall, but also a lot of tension that came out of the Sonko case, or Sonko cases, the case related to the rape allegations, and then another recent case, a defamation case against Sonko, a complaint lodged by a former minister of the government named Mambenya. So all of that together has created an electric tension in the country. And on top of that, we've seen what I can only qualify as a democratic backsliding in the country. Recently, in March 2023, two major reports came out, one from the State Department and another one from Amnesty International. And both of them show that Senegal has taken steps back when it comes to the democratic process. They've shown, for instance, the recurrence of arbitrary detentions. They've also highlighted the repression against protesters. They also highlighted political detention, among other things, including also the lack of independence of the justice system. And on top of that, civil society organizations in Senegal, whether it's the RADO or the FEDH or social movements like Yanamar, they all converge in the same direction, that the Senegalese regime is repressing democracy, repressing freedom of opinion and the most basic liberties. On top of that, we can add that the fact that there is no clarity about Macky Sall's intentions to run for a third term or not. I mean, the constitution is clear. He can only run for two consecutive terms, and he's now finishing his second term. So all of that to say that as we speak, Senegal or the Sall regime exhibits all the symptoms of an autocracy. So unfortunately, that's my opinion of Senegalese democracy as it stands right now.
So, Madam, I wanted to get your take on this as well, you know, responding to Bamba laying out the stakes. Do you see it in a similar way? And, you know, how can we think about this moment in terms of human rights, which Bamba mentioned, you know, are being curtailed according to these reports? Do you have a similarly kind of view of the democratic backsliding?
To some extent, yes, I do. When it comes to President Macky Sall's unwillingness to pronounce openly whether he's going to run or not, because I feel like the nation is taken hostage with him doing that, because we don't know exactly where to stand. If he said that he would run, then people will also react to that. If he said he wouldn't run, we wouldn't know if his party is planning to put forward another candidate and all that stuff. I also think that the stifling of freedom of opinion, I could see some of that, especially when it comes to journalists. For example, there are some journalists that have been jailed and things like that. But at the same time, I am wearing gender lenses here to look at it from the perspective of women and sometimes also young children or young people. What does this mean and where do they stand? And have things changed for them, even for us to say that there's some backsliding? But from the perspective of women, I do not see much of a change when it comes to the condition of women from before to Macky Sall's regime, no moving forward. So to me, the reality for women is very different than the reality for men when it comes to democracy, freedom of opinion, freedom of right on oneself, and all of that stuff. To me, much has not changed from one president to the next. And to me, Macky Sall's regime or Abdoulaye Wade's regime kind of are almost the same in the sense of women's rights, for example. I can even say that there is even a doubling down. So that might join Bamba's point in the sense that there is much more of a stifling. For example, when it comes to the law on parity that was voted during Abdoulaye Wade's, I think it's his second term, we could see that it has not been implemented to the fullest during Macky Sall's regime, and he has not done much to change that.
Right, such an interesting perspective. And as you say, depending on where you sit in society is where you stand and how much has changed from prior regimes, which actually is a really interesting question too, even when we look at the kind of elite transition, the arguments around the third term, right? We have a sense of deja vu from this moment about kind of slight changes to the constitution. Does that justify a kind of restart? Is the same argument that was made for Macky Sall, you know, to come up as opposition. I guess I'm wondering, Omar, if you can tell us, like, do you see this moment as similar to prior contestations over the third term? And if not, what about this might be different? You know, are we in a different moment? Or, you know, to Maram's point, like, we have this kind of continuity in terms of how average citizens might experience democracy or lack thereof?
I think there is a sense of cyclical patterns in how these debates emerge, especially in the Senegalese context. It is true that we already had this moment before, or a similar moment in 2011, when Abdoulaye Wade tried to seek a third term. There was some protests, and prior to even seeking the third term, Abdoulaye Wade tried to change the electoral laws as to allow a presidential ticket with a vice president. He tried to remove the second round, which would allow any candidates that comes out with the majority of votes to be elected, regardless of what the score is, and there were protests. In any case, at the end, it is up to the constitutional court to decide who is actually allowed to run and who is not. That's why we do have courts. That's why we do have a state and institutions. Now, what is different this time, and I think Macky Sall is responsible to this tension to a very large extent, it is his refusal to state clearly what he intends to do. So this is an artificially created tension that he can clear up by stating what his intention is. Now, whether he is allowed to seek a third term or not, it's not as easy to settle the question as some people make it seem to be. I personally, from my reading of those two articles in the Constitution, I think he's not allowed to seek a third term. But I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and these are technical questions, and there are experts on both sides of this issue. There are those who said that the reading of the Constitution clearly states that this is his second and last term. There are those who say, no, you can actually interpret this differently, and that would allow him to seek another term of 5 years because he only had 1 5-year term. Again, me not being a lawyer, I want to, be sure that we follow the process that is in place in this situation, which is that the constitutional court will decide if, again, this is also a big if, because we still do not know whether Macky Sall will run or not. But if he decides to run, then the only course available to us is to listen to what the constitutional court would say and then go to vote. The reality, the other aspect of the question, the political one, is that it is very likely that even if Macky were to run, that he would lose the elections. And I think he knows that, or at least he should be smart enough to know that even if he runs, he may very well lose the elections, which makes me still think that it's still possible that he does not run. But if he decides to run, then, the constitutional court will have to do, for better or worse, its job, which is to say whether he's allowed to run or not. That's what the institutions are for.
So I want to follow up there on the kind of role of the judiciary, because I totally agree. Like, that's what the institutions are there for. And when we look at kind of broader trends across the world, the weaponization of the judiciary is one of the key ways in which we think about kind of democratic backsliding, the use of courts to maintain and centralize power, expand the power of the executive, of incumbents. And so, coming back to you, Umar, first on this, and then to Bamba and Mahamos also, do you think the court will be able to play its democratic role in this context?
That is not a Macky Sall's problem, I think. That's a problem of the Senegalese political class. Prior to Macky Sall, we had all the presidents who appointed judges, and those judges had made rulings. I think the issue is that we should reform these institutions in a way that allows a greater independence of the judiciary. But no one in the political class is willing to do that. If that were the case, why aren't we hearing the opposition proposing legislation that they will introduce to change the system? There is opposition parties in the National Assembly. Why are they not introducing bills that would guarantee a greater independence of the judiciary? It is because they too want to benefit from that if they were ever come to power. That's why when they come to power, they do not change the judicial system. They leave it as it is, and they appoint the judges that they believe would be favorable to them. So in that sense, I think the weaponization of the judiciary is a problem of the political class, not necessarily one of a single president or regime.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly because we see the reliance on the courts in these key moments. The return to the courts and the different role that they can play, it's definitely one that has kind of legacies of prior appointments. And it would be different if we saw the current president, Macky Sall, in this case, making a lot of appointments, right? Changing the appointment mechanisms. That would be a different story in which would, point to some other patterns. And Mariam, how do you see the role of the judiciary and kind of the institutional checks and balances on hand? As Umar mentioned, the role of the legislature, the role of the courts, and also the role of the courts and the legal system in terms of the detention of political activists or opposition, you know, the kinds of things that were brought up in the Amnesty International report. How do you see these as relating to a broader question of the political class? Is it distinctly related to Macky Sall's agenda?
I think that the Senegalese judiciary has been quasi-independent. And as we go back to this sense of deja vu that you talked about, we had the same case in 2011 with Abdoulaye Wade. Yet when he insisted to run on a third term, he was defeated by Macky Sall, even though he was given the right to run for a third term. So I think that as our institutions are there to regulate things, we need to have faith that people will do due process. If this part of the Constitution is so ambiguous to lay people, I don't think it is ambiguous to the judiciary, and they should be able to sit down and read it and tell us what exactly it means. On the part of Macky Sall, I'm not understanding why he is waiting to say that he's running or not. If he understands that the Constitution gives him the right to run for a third term, because the more he waits, the more he antagonizes the voters, even those who will likely vote for him, still do not know whether he has the right to vote or not. And if he's so confident that of his eligibility to run, then let him do it the same way that Abdoulaye Wade had done it and was defeated by him, Macky Sall. So I think that we will have the same thing happen by now, because if you look at the public opinion, even though Macky Sall has supporters, public opinion is leaning against him running for a third term, and that will make it possible for him to be defeated by whoever runs against him, including if Ousmane Sonko gets to there. I'm also bearing in mind his legal entanglements, so to say. But I think that we need to have faith in our judiciary, because I don't see anything that's completely alarming to me that will say that it has been weaponized. We just have people who have not been favored by the justice saying that it's weaponized. Do we have the real proof that it is weaponized is another question.
That's such a great point. And I also, you know, want to point to the role that you've both mentioned, the role of the electorate as the final judge, right? The final arbiter, right? The Justice Department, the courts have their role in determining who's eligible based on the articles of the Constitution. And then the electorate has had their say to ultimately to decide who they want to be president. And so that's, you know, a really important element of the sequential stages. Now, one other element that you bring up is really the status of the opposition, right? Who will be the candidates, and will they mount a potential challenge that would be compelling to the voters? So, Bamba, can you tell us a little bit about Usman Sonko? First of all, you know, kind of what his electoral appeal seems to be, you know, the status of the charges against him, whether or not his legal entanglements, as Maram put it, are probably serious challenges to him participating, and the nature of kind of protests in support of him against the kind of legal rulings.
Yes, I wanted to come back to the previous question before answering the Sonko one, because I agree with Umar when he says that the opposition has or had an opportunity to make things change, especially the way the judicial system works. And another thing that also recently happened, which I found interesting, was Macky Sall gave an interview to L'Express, a newspaper or news media in France, in which he clearly stated that, according to him, the Constitutional Court has basically validated or has confirmed that he can run for a third term. They asked the Constitutional Court if it was legal, and they said yes. And that now what remains is a personal problem, whether he's going to do it or not. So we moved away from the, I am not going to say yes, I am not going to say no concept to, you know, the Constitutional Court said it's legal and now it's a personal problem. So, which indicates to me that clearly he intends to run. He intends to run. Now, historically, we've seen that in cases like this, that the Constitutional Court, they're the legal body to regulate or to legislate on those kind of things. But historically, they sided with the incumbent president. It happened with Abdoulaye Wade, and it seems like it is about to happen with Macky Sall. So I will not be surprised if tomorrow they wake up and say, oh yeah, he can run for a third term. But the problem, I think, of the Constitution is not complicated. It is not rocket science. I'm not a legislator, I know, but it is written in French. And the Article 27 of the Constitution says that nul n'a le droit de faire deux mandats consécutifs. So nobody can have more than two consecutive terms. I think that's pretty clear. And we have a precedent. We have a precedent. Abdoulaye Wade wanted to do the exact same thing, and people said no. So it is really crazy.
But he did, though.
He did. But it is really crazy that we're coming back to this same situation. We're back to ground zero, especially after Macky Sall himself went on a tour to religious, of religious families upon his election in 2012 to say that what happened with Abdoulaye Wade, he will make sure that it doesn't happen again. And he will change the constitution so as to lock it so that no one else can do what Abdoulaye Wade did. This came out of his mouth. The videos are here. So it is just inconceivable that not even 15 years later, we're coming back to the same situation. And this is going to create, hopefully it's not going to create a catastrophe. So I think that was important to mention. And the independence of the justice system in Senegal, or the lack thereof, is not new. It's not new. The Conseil Supérieur de la Magistrature themselves, they protested a couple of years ago that the executive has too much control over the judiciary. They protested against that. And I think, again, to come back to what Omar said, we need now to move away from the time period when the judges and the in the Constitutional Court and Supreme Court are appointed by the president. And that is what is happening. They always stack those courts with their people, people who are loyal to them, people who will, approve whatever comes to them. And that is currently what is happening right now. I'll be surprised if the Constitutional Court says no to Macky Sall for a third term. Now, coming back to Sonko, so he is still facing two major cases. The first one was the accusation against the rape accusation and death threat accusations by Ajisar. Now, something really interesting happened during the hearing, because it took 2 years for the preliminary hearing to happen. And I think it's also important to mention that the first thing that I thought was interesting was during the hearing, they thought or they talked about a role that the former attorney general might have played in the preliminary investigations. César Sonko's lawyers were saying that, for instance, he added some salacious pictures to the file and made it seem like it was pictures from the massage parlor. And they debunked that, to a point that the attorney general, or former attorney general, came out and did a press conference to also deny those allegations. So that, I think, was interesting. The second thing that happened during the hearing was that a man named Mamour M. Sinyas, who I call the self-proclaimed religious guide of Ajisar, submitted 6 audio recordings of him and Ajisar. And in one of the recordings, and the recordings are available on YouTube, and the Senegalese media reported on those thoroughly. One of the recordings, you can hear them talking, and Nyas is asking Aji, like, did this really happen? The allegation, did it really happen? And her response was, and I'm just reporting what's in that recording, was like, no, somebody named Mamour Diallo was behind all of that. And of course, when things like that leaked or are in the public domain, there are a lot of supputations, a lot of speculations. Some people are like, this is not authentic, this is authentic. Then the judge himself, Maham Diallo, summoned Ajisar, who confirmed the authenticity of the recordings, but she did say that in that conversation, she was trying to test the loyalty of Nyas. and that she just said that to see if he would, you know, keep to test his loyalty. However, when that came out, it kind of challenged also the narrative of the accusation in the eyes of the public court, opinion, right? Which was already, I guess, in favor of Ousmane Sonko in many regards. But those were really interesting. On top of that, also, the doctor who consulted the accuser also came out and talked more about the report, the medical report, and also talked about death threats that he's been receiving. He went on national, on TV to talk about that since then, since the Ousmane Sonko Ajisar case, he's been receiving death threats and calling for the government to protect him. So I think those were quite interesting developments that happened. And on top of that, we have the defamation case against Ousmane Sonko. So a complaint lodged by Mambe Nya, who was accused of embezzling or mismanaging about 29 billion CFA. And Sonko cited a so-called a report that condemned Mambe Nya. But instead of saying that the report came from a body of the government called IGF, Sonko said IGE. So, and because of that, I guess, so he lodged a complaint. And then the result just came out, the verdict. So Sonko was found guilty, and he got, I think, 2 months of a sentence, and then like 200 million of a fine that he has to pay to Mambe Nya. But what all of those did is it seems like they solidify Sonko's candidacy or Sonko's image in the eyes of the public. I mean, we all saw the way he was treated by the police, the brutality that he was victim of last month, and some of the videos, those videos, I think, went viral. And it seems like he's trying to capitalize on that, the fact that the regime is not basically capable of letting him, for lack of a better word, be. It seems like he lives, he's living under siege or under house arrest. He cannot move freely. And all of that, I think he's capitalizing on it. And if he manages to be a candidate, I think that could play in his favor.
So there's so many interesting things there. And I wanted to turn to Maram because in particular, thinking about the first case, you know, and the way in which, well, with both cases, you know, the suggestion that Bamba just made that it maybe solidifies a certain view of Sonko as being, you know, under attack by the state, by Macky Sall and, you know, by the ruling party. And I'm just wondering, you know, given, again, kind of putting on a human rights and a gender lens in particular, do you think that these cases complicate the narrative of who Sonko is, what he stands for, and what kind of a politician or leader he would be?
I think that definitely the case Ajisar against Sonko has been politicized to an extent that it can blur the lines about whether he can be guilty of what she's accusing him of or not, especially in the wake of a very important election that 2024 is for Senegal. But at the same time, we need to look at it from the perspective of gender and the attack on women's bodies and what that means. Because when I hear people talk about Ousmane Sonko not being able to move, I cringe because I think about Adissa, who has been in hiding. She's guarded every single time. She is receiving so many death threats that you cannot count. So to me, just for saying that, coming out and saying that she's accusing him, and she has the right to accuse him. He is a citizen of the country. She is a citizen of the country. So they have the same right under the law, whether he is the most popular opposition leader or not. He is a citizen of the nation like she is. And his supporters completely put a blind eye on the initial action that Ousmane Sonko took, which he doesn't deny, to leave his house under a pandemic curfew, cover his face, say, and claiming that he has acute back pain, that he could not sit at home and wait until the morning or even call the paramedics to come get him, but then drove his car himself to go to this shady massage parlor. Let's not even talk about whether something happened between him and Adissa or not. That itself, to me, is not a good judgment from the perspective of an opposition leader who has garnered 19% of the vote in the past election and is very popular. Just that. Now we move to the trial between him and Adissa. I'm amazed at how swift the trial between him and Mambe Niar took place. Within weeks, literally, it unfolded. A sentence was so. I bring here this notion of the misogyny of itself, of the state and its our institutions, because now everybody is afraid of touching the Adissa Sonko case because of the repercussions it can have on the nation, based on the fact that Ousmane Sonko's followers are literally terrorizing anybody who gives Adissa the benefit of the doubt. Anybody, including on social media, anywhere, you cannot talk about it. And then at the same time, we talked about the weaponization of the judiciary, but there is also this very, it's alarming to me, the sanctification of Ousmane Sonko. His followers call him the Holy One. Kutedki, the Holy One. He cannot do anything wrong. Even in the rhetoric and the imagery, when you see Ousmane Sonko, he is up, everybody else is down. And to me, that is so dangerous for the nation itself, yet it contradicts this whole action that he took to go to this massage parlor. Like the technicalities of the fact that he was so intent on going there, as somebody who aspires to be at the highest position in our nation, does not give me anything valuable to say about his candidacy or him as our leader. But the fact that he does not respect the institutions also, this is the judiciary is the institution that's going to swear him in if he were to become president. So how can you aspire to be the president and you do not respect that? And all these legal entanglements that I'm talking about are of his own making. Whether he's at fault or not, these are his own personal decisions. So why is it that every time that the judiciary says, come in, like he's summoned, he calls on the youth to come out? When he was going to see to the parlor, he never called on anybody. He went on his own. when he was accusing Mamdouh Niang, whatever he said, he did it on his own. So if, for example, Macky Sall had come out and said that I am running for a third term and the judiciary said that he cannot run, if Ousmane Sonko calls on the electorate to come out, that would make sense to me. But calling on people to come out to defend something that's of his own making, personal making, I think is wrong. And I think that he is trying to avoid a trial with Agissar, because there is something there that he's afraid of that will actually expose him or his true nature to the people who are behind him.
That's really an interesting point, both in terms of the gender, but also in terms of the timing and the strategies around the judicial institutions, right? Like the move to protest, when do you mobilize supporters to take to the streets, around which types of contestations, which types of issues, and whether or not they're in support of the institutions of democracy as we see them. Umar, how do you see it in terms of the status of the opposition? You know, are there other viable candidates? What is Zonko's kind of electoral appeal and the status of his candidacy?
I mean, currently, Sonko is definitely the opposition figure, the leading opposition figure. He's the most popular candidate among the opposition. Although there are other ones too, even within his own coalition, there are other potential candidates, including Khalifa Sall, the former mayor of Dakar. It's possible that the current mayor of Dakar, Baltemi Jazz, may also be a candidate. But there's also a large number of candidates. I think in any case, we probably will have maybe about 10 or 15 candidates for the second round. If Sonko were to be able to run, depending on the outcome of his legal troubles, that would play in his favor as well, because the more candidates there are, the more split there will be in the votes, then there's going to be a lesser chance for the incumbent to, or the candidates of the Macky Sall's party, whoever that would be, to win in the first round. So there will be a second round, and typically what has happened would be that all the opposition figures would rally behind the leading opposition candidate. So he does have a good chance of being that candidate if there is a second round, facing the candidate from the current government's coalition. That being said, there's also a lot of discourse about how Sonko is persecuted by the state, how there is a conspiracy to try to prevent him from running. I think we should separate the political effects of the tension and the trials from the legal cases. I don't believe there is a state conspiracy against Sonko, because nobody kidnapped Sonko and took him to that message parlor where he has been accused of rape. He got in his car, took himself there, and was a regular customer to that place, where a young woman who was 20 years old, who, by the way, is not a qualified masseuse. So basically, him being a member of the parliament, having health care, having a lot of good money, being able to seek medical advice if he has back pain, chose instead to go to a shady massage parlor, which was in fact a prostitution ring, let's call it what it is, where he has been accused of rape. So there's no conspiracy there, none. Mm-mm. Now we have to let the system run its course. There will be a trial. The trial will be public. Any citizen can go and attend the trial, and then we'll see justice being delivered. The other case about him is he has accused someone of having embezzled a lot of money. That person filed a complaint for defamation against him. He couldn't prove that the accusation were true, and he was found guilty and sentenced to 2 months of probation. That's normal stuff in a normal state. There's no conspiracy there. The two things there. Either Sonko doesn't know the law, that's why he keeps breaking it, by accusing people without proof of having embezzled the money, that's breaking the law, or he doesn't care about the law, actually, and willingly breaks it and then calls on people to go and protest and do all these insurrectional acts for him not to face the consequences of his words or his deeds. A person who is running for president, who is well-placed to actually be the next president, should either be smart enough to know what to say and what to do, or surround himself with people who can give him good advice. And that's not the case, which makes me worry a lot about his judgment.
I second that.
So let's talk about another kind of judgment call, which is, as you've mentioned, kind of Zonko's willingness to call protesters to the streets, right, in support of him and against the judicial processes. So Bamba, I was wondering if you could tell us how you see first kind of the role of civic mobilizations. We've seen a lot of protest, which on one hand has really been a backbone, you know, a really important element of Senegalese democracy, you know, citizens willing to go out and share their views, wanting to make sure that, you know, they're claiming their voice. So how do you see the kind of current role of civic mobilizations, protest, who's involved, who's going out, and on what grounds?
There's a correlation that can be made between this rise of this protest cycle or wave of protest and, you know, the lack of trust that Senegalese people have vis-a-vis the regime, but also vis-a-vis the judicial system in general. And one thing that is important here is that the protest is not necessarily fueled by the opposition or Sonko and his partisan. This is a more generalized, you know, tendency where you have the opposition, you have social movements, right? Traditional civil society, and even religious figures, right? Calling for people to not accept, right, what is currently happening in Senegal, which is this the fact that the country is verging on autocracy. In March, close to 500 people, protesters, were jailed. Protesting is a constitutional right. It is upheld by the Constitution of Senegal. People have the right to protest, and it is up to the government to protect them and make sure that they express their opinion freely. But what is happening right now is, unfortunately, we are seeing a severe, extreme policing of protests in Senegal. In 2021, 14 people died, all of them in the hands of the police. So far, there has not been any investigation. There is nobody was responsible for that. And that is problematic in itself. And when people say the justice system is not working and is weaponized, it's because of things like that. There are more important things that they should be focused. Who killed those 14 young boys, kids? And so far, there is no responsible. Nobody is guilty for that. So there is what we call a deux poids, deux mesures. When people in the opposition do things, well, the justice system rushes and try to, you know, try people and find, you know, responsible people, people who are responsible, and takes action swiftly. And I agree with Marem when you mentioned earlier that, you know, the swiftness with which they tried the Sonko Mambenya case versus how they are dragging their feet when it comes to the Ajisar case, that in itself is a token of how broken the judicial system is, right? And on top of that, we've seen, for instance, just give you an example. Ousmane Sonko was not the first person to say that Mambenya mismanaged the funds. Birayim Sek wrote a whole book about that, detailing how the mismanagement of funds took place in the Ministry of the Last Jeunesse, where Mambenya was the minister. A whole book. Nobody called Birayim Sek. He went himself to court last month to testify. He said, hey, call me. I'm the one who wrote the book. I want to testify. The judge told him, get out of here. Amadou Ba, who was the Minister of Finance, himself went to the National Assembly and was asked by the MPs if there was a report about a potential mismanagement of funds in the Ministry of the Last Jeunesse. He confirmed that. He is currently the Prime Minister of Senegal, right? Mambenya himself said that, yes, there was a report himself. I'm not making this up. These are facts. And the Senegalese media has reported on that, and the videos are out there. So for them to come and say, you know, well, this person is making this up and he has no proof of what he's saying, that's just not correct. What is happening is that there are two justice systems. One for the regime, where people who are with the regime can call for insurrections, can call for one group to kill another group, and there is no consequences. Ahmed Suzan Camara, very close to the to Macky Sall and member of the APR, came out and say, go and burn down the houses of the passive folks, for instance. Even if you find Sonko in his house, burn him alive. Nothing happened, right? What's his name? Journalist, Walfajri journalist, Pap Ndiaye. He's currently in prison. Hip hop artist, what's his name? Nick Duff, also currently in prison, right? For things that they say or they wrote on social media, and they call that insurrectional. But when it comes to the other side, nothing happens. That is the problem of the justice system. That is the problem of Senegal. And that is why people are protesting, because people are upset. People are mad. They do not trust that the justice system will do its work properly. And their only weapon is the weapon of mass protest.
So Omar, I'm going to come to you here, and because, you know, combining the sense of mass protests with the functioning of the judicial system, do you think that, you know, they are coming to a head, and is that a part and parcel of how we see the role of civic mobilization right now and what it's what protest is oriented around? And do you see the judicial system as being capable of finding that kind of, or projecting its legitimacy for everyone in the country?
Yeah, I think, again, looking back at history, I don't see this moment as being particularly different or unique in Senegalese political history. We've had these similar movements. We had similar tensions before. We had leaders of the opposition thrown in jail. That did happen under Senghor, happened under Diouf, happened under Wade, it's happening under Macky Sall. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure it will not happen again if Sonko were to become president. So that, for better or worse, is part of our political history. Now, in terms of the judiciary, I want also to distinguish two things here. There's an issue of the political violence and repression and the issue of the judiciary. It is part of Senegalese history, and that's a tragedy, I think, that our daily encounters with the police and the gendarmerie are always made of violence. The most mundane daily encounters regular citizens have with the security forces are violent encounters. If you go to a police station even to get, a piece of paper notarized, you see that violence in how these interactions go. So that's a different matter from whether the judicial system is functioning or not. I think I would expect more from the political class to think about the system, the judicial system is broken in terms of people who don't deserve to go to jail are in jail. The Senegalese jails are overcrowded because they're over-arresting people. Trials take forever. People without any money have legally no chance of getting a fair trial because they can't afford lawyers. This is what I would have expected politicians to pay attention to in terms of how the system is broken. Not that this activist or this, political guy is thrown to jail because they broke the law. There's in the Senegalese legal code that says if you call for an insurrection, you broke the law. And if you broke the law, you could be arrested. It's as simple as that. So to me, that's not where the focus should be.
Okay, Merham, I'm giving closing thoughts to you in terms of civic mobilization around rights and the role of the judiciary in, its legitimacy as a kind of a force for the nation.
I think going back to the event of 2021, those people that died, Ousmane Sonko called on them to come out. Our institutions, especially the government, the law, is here to protect citizens. So we have freedom of speech, of course. But when you have an authorized peaceful demonstration, you are given a route to take and recommendations and guidelines about how you should proceed in order to enforce public safety. So now if you have people who do not abide by those laws when they are arrested, I don't think it is the fault of the police that they are arrested. Ousmane Sonko's followers have this belligerent attitude about terrorizing people. Just recently, I was in Dakar when he said that he was going to have a rally, he's going to have a, I don't know how he calls it again. Taxi drivers the day before were saying that tomorrow we're not going to be out because Sonko and his followers are going to be out. So for him to say that he is unbinding the nation, I think with his modus operandi, now with his followers, he is actually binding the nation. People are terrorized to come out when he plans a demonstration or something like that. So again, I think that if he and his followers were left to do whatever they want, then we wouldn't have an institution at all. We wouldn't have a government. And that's what our government is there for. You cannot want to be the president of a nation and not follow the law in that nation, except to be exempted from not following the law. So I see a weaponization of the youth who are completely blind because of course, their condition or perceived lack of attention from the current government are following him blindly. And whenever he says, get up, they will get up. And he knows that and is weaponizing it to pin all those issues against the government by saying that the government killed those people. But nobody but him called those young people to come out when he was accused of rape over him going to a shady massage parlor on his own. So I think that we need to be a little bit, you know, fair to the government and our institution, even as we are against Macky Sall's maybe desire to run for a third term, to say that our institutions are put in place to protect us. And when they don't, then we don't have them anymore. So it needs to be clear. The other aspect of this is the fact that women's rights are being trampled over. The fact that even religious leaders will come out without any proof and say that this was a complot against Ousmane Sonko. They don't have any proof. If he is accused and he is not guilty, then go to trial and defend yourself, bring your proof of you being innocent. But do not put all these young people in the line, knowing that whenever you say get up, they get up. He doesn't even tell them to protest peacefully. So what kind of a leader is he going to be when he becomes president then? Those are the questions that I put forward. And what would be the condition of women in that kind of a country that is led by Ousmane Sonko, who himself is accused of sexually violating a woman? So those are the questions that I put forward in terms of, if Macky Sall doesn't run and Ousmane Sonko runs and wins, what is going to happen when it comes to our judiciary, when it comes to the rights of women? And the third aspect that I see here, I have never heard Ousmane Sonko have a plan for Senegal.
He has a whole book called Solution.
All I hear is Macky Sall cannot run for a third term. There are state secrets that I have, but there is no real plan that I hear. Maybe if he runs and then has a campaign, he can unfold those. But I haven't heard any concise plan for how to overturn things. Okay, the state is, the government is manipulating. It's not doing its job. Okay, now you've exposed them. Then what? What are you going to put in place? What are you going to do?
So, in fact, you know, it's really interesting to hear, you know, these perspectives that you've shared. And actually, the critique of Macky Sall in some ways is a consistent critique of Sonko, in a sense of needing to follow the rules, follow the constitution, bolster the institutions of the state, the legitimacy of the judiciary, the legitimacy of the constitutional court, and that leaders, particularly those who hope to hold the highest office, need to conduct themselves as the highest level. And so we're looking at that, right, Bamba, yeah, in terms of a critique of the president and his set of decisions, and a critique of, you know, the potential, yeah, opposition figures. So
I mean, there is it would have been awesome if, you know, like you said, people at the helm of the country could set themselves a good example for people to follow. But unfortunately, it's not the case. The regime of Macky Sall has been conspicuous for, you know, mismanagement, embezzlement, you know, repression, at levels never seen before, to be honest. Even what at some point his regime was bad when it comes to those things. But Macky, I think, like, you know, Macky's regime topped everything. And so sometimes it bothers me when I hear people say that, you know, oh, people should follow the law, of course people should, but the lawmakers also should, you know, follow the law. They cannot break it. They're not above it. They're not under it, right? Justice should be applied for all. And another thing is that I think it's important to, I think it's important to say that Sonko does have a plan, I think. I mean, he wrote a whole book about that called Solution. The other thing is also, no matter how bad the justice system is in a given place, it's important to also recognize and remember that people are innocent or presumed innocent, you know, until proven guilty. So just like we should give Ajisao the benefit of the doubt, the same way we should give Usman Sonko the benefit of the doubt, and hoping that there will be a fair and transparent trial to elucidate the whole this whole legal case. So, you know, I think those are important to mention. Now, in the meantime, Macky Sall also need to clarify his position. Now he made it clear that it's no longer a judicial or a problem of the constitutional court. He said that last week. Now it is a personal problem. So the Senegalese people are waiting for him to make this, you know, to make it clear so that the people can move forward peacefully.
So Bamba, with that, I'm going to say we'll be staying tuned. Thank you so much, Maram, Umar, Bamba, for your expertise. It was just really such an honor to be able to learn from you and hear your perspectives.
Thank you. It was a good conversation.
Bye, everyone.
Bon dogu.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. Our non-resident podcast fellows are Bamba Njaye, Maseke Rioba, Takono Priscilla Sempere, and Kamohelo Tanigo Toledi. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.